protocolized therapy actually useful in all settings?
The ED is not a great place to board patients.
The interventions of fluids and vasopressors didn't appear to have an effect at all.
Do ED ventilatory settings make a difference?
We're over-sedating people routinely. I mean, way too deep.
This study really shows that not everybody should be put in that same box.
Greetings and welcome back, everyone, to Critical Care Perspectives in Emergency Medicine. I'm Mike Winters from the University of Maryland School of Medicine in Baltimore, and I am joined with my stellar co-host, Dr. Peter W. from LSU, Dr. Rob Rodriguez from UCSF, and Dr. John Greenwood from Penn in Philadelphia. Gentlemen, excited here on part two of our top articles of 2017. Our last podcast was outstanding, had a number of pearls from transfusions, from vasopressors, from apneic oxygenation to thrombolytic therapy in PE. I can't wait for what's in store over these next five articles we have. John, how are you this month?
Doing great, Mike. Thanks so much for asking. Ready to get started on this second half. We got some good stuff ahead, it looks like.
Me too. Peter, how are you?
Doing great. Looking for a new year that brings some new opportunities for us to take care of the patients a little bit better.
Absolutely. And Rob, how are you this week?
Doing well. Doing very well. Just look forward to another great year of critical care perspectives.
All right. Well, with that, let's go into part two of our top articles from 2017. Now, we did not talk about sepsis in part one. And earlier in the year, we did do a dedicated podcast on the Surviving Sepsis Campaign updated guidelines. So we're not going to review those here. What we are going to touch on are just a few quick articles with respect to sepsis care, and perhaps they challenge what we currently think about, and there's also some nice take-home pearls. So, John, I'm going to turn to you for article number six here in our top articles, and tell us about the time to treatment and mortality trial done by Seymour.
Absolutely, Mike. So this was a study by Chris Seymour, who's very well known for his big data research. And this study in particular was looking at the treatment bundles, so the 3 and 6 hour bundle and its impact on sepsis outcomes. So this was a retrospective observational study using the New York Department of Health sepsis database, probably one of the most robust sepsis databases in the United States. So it includes about 185 hospitals, and he studied patients between the times of April 2014 to June 2016. And there were essentially two comparison groups. So of the groups, there were about 50,000 patients with severe sepsis or septic shock, and this was using the sepsis 2 definition, who had completed or did not complete the 3-hour bundle. And they also looked at the 6-hour sepsis bundle. Now, the 3-hour bundle, what they included in that particular group were blood cultures before antibiotics, so a diagnostic test, lactate measurement, also a diagnostic test, and administration of broad spectrum antibiotics, so an intervention. Now, the 6-hour bundle included the interventions of a 30 ml per kilo fluid bolus, vasopressors for refractory hypotension, and then a repeat assessment of lactic acid level. So the primary outcome was in-hospital mortality, and they also looked at odds ratio per hour delay in fluid blood culture testing, as well as antibiotic administration. And what they found was quite interesting. So the odds ratio of dying increased by 1.04 per hour of completing the 3-hour bundle. So the odds ratio of dying with delayed fluid bolus, however, really didn't make a difference at all, nor did per hour delay of blood cultures. So what was the takeaway point of this? Well, it's actually quite interesting in that of the two different bundles, both the 3 and the 6-hour bundle, the 3-hour bundle being the only intervention of timely antibiotics actually made a significant impact on patient survival, whereas the interventions of fluids and vasopressors didn't appear to have an effect at all. So this highlights that early source control is imperative. Absolutely need to get antibiotics in these patients as fast as possible. And the more rapid completion of this 3-hour bundle and rapid administration of antibiotics are really what seems to be the most important signal to take away from this retrospective study.
Rob, what do you think about that in terms of early antibiotics?
Yeah, I think that it's very clear. It's becoming even more robust in terms of the differences in terms of getting antibiotics on board as soon as possible. I think that this study really should point us to focus on getting antibiotics as soon as possible and not wasting a bunch of time trying to get that second blood culture. That point cannot be emphasized enough. When we are too protocolized at times in terms of trying to get blood cultures before we give antibiotics as per our protocols, you can actually do harm.
And Peter, to that end, any broad spectrum antibiotics?
You know, it's all going to be linked from my perspective on suspected source, right? So I think with today's pressure with antibiotic stewardship program, it's going to be almost selective to our individual institutions, and we should be following those guidelines. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely, in terms of ensuring adequate and appropriate antimicrobial coverage. So what is the sensitivities? What are the bugs and sensitivities you have or all of our providers have in their respective communities? What has the patient been previously cultured with? What resistant organisms do they have? Simply not just the reflexive combination doesn't satisfy all comers, you know, thinking right. Carefully about antibiotic choices.
We used to call it the Holy Trinity, where everybody got Vanc, Zos, and Cipro. And again, we've rethought that very strongly.
Well, thanks, John, for getting us started here with this article in terms of the importance of antibiotic administration. Now, throughout that discussion, you had mentioned, we all mentioned actually, protocolized therapy. Rob, I'm going to turn to you. Is protocolized therapy actually useful in all settings?
Yeah, so this is a great study from JAMA. Very important to our third world treatment populations. This was by Andrews et al. And the study was effect of an early resuscitation protocol on in-hospital mortality among adults with sepsis and hypotension, a randomized clinical trial. And what they left out in this title, which I think they really should have put in there, is this is a different setting, as you alluded to. This was a study that was conducted in an African population in Zambia, basically. So we all know that mortality from sepsis remains pretty high and that the use of protocols, as we've reported many times, can be used to reduce mortality in developed nations. But do these protocols result in improved outcomes in less developed countries? There was a trial called the FEAST trial that demonstrated increased mortality with IV fluid administration in a select African population. And this study brought into question our protocols of giving bolus therapies for sepsis. So the specific objective of this study was to determine whether the resuscitation protocol implemented soon after ED presentation improved in-hospital mortality compared with usual care in this African country. So it was a randomized controlled trial at one university center in Zambia, included all adult patients, suspected sepsis with two or more surge criteria. They also had to have hypotension with systolic blood pressure less than 90. Or a MAP less than 65. And the intervention was an initial bolus of 2 liter isotonic crystalloid within 1 hour of enrollment, and an additional 2 liters over the subsequent 4 hours, and then a protocol of fluid monitoring by IVP, respiratory rate, and using mixed venous saturations. The protocols called for dopamine if the MAP was less than 65 after completion of the initial 2 liters. And a blood transfusion to maintain hemoglobin above 7. The control group had treating clinicians determining IV fluid amounts, vasopressors, and blood transfusions. So again, it was a protocol versus basically clinician judgment. And the treating clinicians determined antibiotic selection in both groups. Their primary outcome was in-hospital mortality. So they enrolled 212 patients, 107 in the intervention group and 105 in the control group. Of note, 89% of patients were also HIV positive. And the in-hospital mortality of the intervention group was 48.1% versus the control group, which was much lower at 33%, giving the number needed to harm with protocolized therapy of 7, which is pretty substantial. They also noted that the median hospital length of stay was lower in the intervention group. The control group wound up receiving less IV fluids, 3.5 liters versus 2 liters, and only about half of them got any IV fluids, and less than 2% of the control group received a vasopressor. So the limitations of this study were that almost all patients were HIV positive. This was about 90%. It was a single center study in Zambia, which sort of limits the generalizability of this study. They also used convenient sampling to recruit patients. They used atypical vasopressor. We're not using dopamine so often anymore in developed countries. And patients in the intervention group got 2 liters of IV fluids in the first hour, and the IV fluids weren't always necessarily titrated to hemodynamic parameters. So the take-home point from this study was, in this setting, in a primarily HIV-positive patient resource-limited setting, the sepsis protocol of early IV fluids and vasopressors increased mortality compared with usual care. So the answer to your question up front, Mike, is that protocols don't always work in different settings.
Yeah, very, very surprising, and something that, or a study that got a lot of attention as 2017 closed out. John, and then Peter, what are your thoughts on this particular study?
To be honest, this along with the FEAST trial are probably two of the most thought-provoking sepsis trials that have been published in the past 5 to maybe even longer years. I think in developed countries, we're pressed so hard, early fluids, early vasopressors, and as we mentioned before with the Seymour study, that what actually is important, it's source control. Now, it did appear in this trial that antibiotic timing was relatively consistent between the two study groups. So the question is, where did the difference come out in this particular patient population? Are they different? And third world country populations, at least the way we deliver healthcare, may be a little bit different. And so it's important, as we think about protocols, that everyone on the team is playing their part and is doing an effective job. So it'll be really interesting to see more from other countries, not just in the United States, England, Australia, trials of protocolized care and how it impacts sepsis outcomes.
Peter?
I'm going to be a little bit rogue on this. And I would just tell you that if we look back in the last 15 years and said, ooh, let's follow all the surviving sepsis campaign recommendations and see how strongly they are linked to outcomes, about 20% of those recs are still here today, right? So I'm not sold on protocolized care and saying that makes a difference. I am sold on early institution of antibiotics and source control. I am sold on using mechanical ventilation in a clever way so you don't harm your patients. I am somewhat sold on not tolerating frank hypotension and chasing it with fluids and instituting a vasopressor earlier on, although I have to point back to that data and say it's not the most powerful and wouldn't be surprised 10 years from now if I was way wrong on that. But again, I think we should be more humble with understanding the strength of the evidence and how it's changed over time, instead of, I picked up a study and I'm applying it, you know, I have a new hammer, everything looks like a nail.
I love that analysis, Peter. I think that provides excellent perspective. One thing I would add on as well is that protocolized therapies tend to put everybody in the same box. And so this study really shows that not everybody should be put in that same box. Patients with HIV, there have been other studies that have shown that careful fluid management of these patients instead of automatic bolus of fluids are maybe the way to go. So instead of protocolized therapies, putting everybody in the same box, I think this really calls for tailored sepsis therapy and tailored protocols, if you will.
You guys said it exceedingly well. Well, let's keep moving here. One more sepsis article for number 8 of our top 10, and that actually still deals with antimicrobial coverage. And this is in regards actually to the second dose of antibiotics. So we've talked about the importance of timely administration of the first broad-spectrum antimicrobial agents. This appeared in Critical Care Medicine midway through 2017. Lead author was Leisman, entitled Delayed Second Dose Antibiotics for Patients Admitted from the Emergency Department with Sepsis: Prevalence, Risk Factors, and Outcomes. So as we've talked about, we want to get antibiotics on board, preferably within the first hour from time zero when we recognize sepsis with organ dysfunction or septic shock. But how much attention has really been paid to giving that second dose, and could a delay in second dose of antimicrobial agents actually impact patient-centered outcomes? So the overall objective of this study was to quantify, well, how commonly are delays in second dose of antibiotic administration in patients with sepsis or septic shock? They also wanted to say, well, what were the risk factors for those delays in care? And then they conducted an exploratory analysis associating the delays with mortality in terms of overall patient outcome. So this was a retrospective cohort study. Patients were admitted from the ED with sepsis or septic shock. Now, this was conducted at a single suburban academic medical center in New York, and they included adult patients with sepsis and septic shock whose initial presentation was through the emergency department. And in terms of the time of antibiotics, what they did is they went by the Sanford's Guide to Antibiotic Therapy. In other words, if a certain antimicrobial had a 6-hour repeat dosing or an 8-hour or a 12 or 24-hour dosing interval, that's what they used as the recommended interval for the second dose. And before beginning the study, they defined a major delay as any time greater than or equal to 25% or more of that recommended time interval. Their primary outcome was, in fact, how often were major delays occurring, and then for their exploratory analysis, what was the impact on in-hospital mortality. Overall, they had a little over 825 patients, and I think an alarming statistic, one out of every three had a major delay in the second dose of antibiotic administration. In fact, the median of that delay was almost 80%, and no surprise, ED boarding was an additional independent predictor of delays in second dose of antibiotics. And in terms of their exploratory analysis, major delays were associated with an increase to the tune of 1.6 times in hospital mortality and a 2.4 times the odds of patients needing mechanical ventilation. Now, this was a single site. This was retrospective design. And overall, they did not take a look or record source control, calculate illness severity, or in fact the causative organisms. But I think it brings home a point that we really haven't touched on before, and that's the second dose of antibiotic. And the take-home points are, at least in this particular study of over 800 patients, one out of every three had a delay greater than 25% in their second dose of antibiotics. And the major delays were, in fact, associated with an increase in in-hospital mortality. And no surprise, boarding patients were an independent predictor of these delays. John, thoughts on this particular study?
Well, yeah, Mike, I think it highlights a very important issue amongst many issues, but one of them being patient handoffs. Certainly, this can happen in the emergency department, but as that patient transitions from the ED to the inpatient setting, there's a lot of dynamic factors, and whether or not it's keeping track of how much fluids they've gotten, when their last antibiotic was, as well as just the accepting team going through the records, there's a lot of opportunity for time delays that can happen between emergency department inpatient side. So I think this highlights an important issue of good communication between the provider taking on the patient as well as the signing off provider to make sure that your patients are getting continuous high quality care.
Rob, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think this is a cool little study. I really, really like the novel idea. And I would second the points that John made. And yeah, we just have to pay more attention to these patients.
Peter, anything to add?
No, I would just echo what John and Rob said. You know, transitions of care, whether they occur from the ED to the ICU, from the floor to the ICU, it doesn't matter what that transition is. Our patients are at profound risk. And this adds to the data that's growing mightily that's saying the ED is not a great place to board patients. Despite our efforts, our patients are placed in harm's way if they stay within the ED for protracted periods of time.
Great, great point. Well, Peter, let's shift from sepsis, which is our most common critical illness, to our most common critical care intervention, and that's mechanical ventilation. And let me, I guess, just pose the question to you. Do ED ventilatory settings make a difference?
Absolutely. This is something that I've kind of preached for my entire career, academically at least. And so this is Fuller et al., lung protective ventilation initiated in the emergency department, known as the LOVE-ED study. It's a quasi-experimental before-after trial published in Annals of Emergency Medicine. So some of the background, approximately 250,000 patients receive mechanical ventilation in U.S. emergency departments each and every year. Pulmonary complications, both ARDS, ventilator-associated pneumonias, develop in about 20% of ED patients receiving mechanical ventilation. Time spent in the ED is a vulnerable period, something I just mentioned with the previous study. Recent evidence does suggest that potentially injurious ventilator practices are common in the ED. And we've reviewed those studies here before, talking about low tidal volume ventilation and the adoption of that practice within the ED. Initial ventilator settings influence future delivery of lung protective ventilation. So again, much like antibiotic choices, much like vasopressor or fluid choices, mechanical ventilation choices that are made in the ED go to the ICU and stick in the ICU. Same thing with analgesic orders or sedation orders. In many cases, they carry through and they're not changed. So it's important to understand that the choices we make in the emergency department make a big difference in our critical care patients. So the objective for the study is to evaluate the effectiveness of an ED-based lung protective mechanical ventilatory protocol on reducing the incidence of pulmonary complications. So the study design, again, they call it a quasi-experimental before-after study, consisted of a pre-intervention period, which went from 2009 to 2014, running in period during which lung protective ventilation was implemented as a standard approach, and then intervention period 2014 to 2016. It was a single center, so just one house, academic, tertiary medical center, emergency department, and ICU. The patients, consecutively ventilated ED patients, these were all adult patients 18 years and older, and mechanical ventilation through an endotracheal tube. The intervention. So after intubation, the respiratory therapist obtained an accurate height with a tape measure. Again, a low-cost intervention to give your RTs tape measures. Tidal volume was set to 6 cc's per kilogram based on body weight range, 6 to 8 cc's per kilogram if no ARDS. So based on predicted body weight along with the height. The head of bed elevation to greater than 30 degrees. PEEP was set to greater than or equal to 5 centimeters. And PEEP was higher for elevated BMI patients, which we encourage. They initiated FiO2 at 30 to 40% after intubation, titrated to maintain saturations 90 to 95%, so that's pretty progressive. If hypoxic, used PEEP table for FiO2 PEEP combination. They set the respiratory rate to 20 to 30 breaths per minute, and they measure and limit plateau pressures less than 20 centimeters. All interventions were performed by emergency department clinical staff. So let's look at the primary outcome. The composite of pulmonary complications after admission. So looking at ARDS and ventilator-associated conditions. So what are the results? 1,705 patients, 1,192 of those were in the pre-intervention group, and then 513 in the intervention group. The tidal volumes reduced by a median of 1.8 cc's per kilo in predicted body weight, and lung-protected ventilation increased by 48% in the ED. Also, ICU tidal volumes decreased by a median of 1.1 cc per kilogram predicted body weight, and lung-protected ventilation increased by 30.7%. The primary outcome, absolute risk reduction of 7.1%. Also increased in ventilator-free days, ICU-free days, and hospital-free days. Absolute risk reduction for mortality of 14.5%. Limitations, again, this was a before and after study design, which is really prone to temporal trends, and these can lead to independent changes in care. And then the issue is this causation or is it association? Again, weakness of a single center study, and then some imbalances between the two groups. Really, the major take-home point is ED ventilator settings make a difference. This is a brilliant, brilliant template to do quality studies in your own ED. Just kind of look at before and after and follow through with what's going on in your ICUs after the ED. So just something to think about. You guys, your thoughts on this study?
I think this is probably one of my favorite studies of 2017 in terms of really not a new medication, doing all low to no cost interventions and putting it together really truly did have a significant impact upon ED vented patients, not only in the ED, but also translated up in the ICU. So one of my favorite for 2017 for sure. John, how about you?
I just have to echo everything that's been said already. I mean, I think, Mike, you hit the nail on the head with a low-cost, high-impact intervention. I think this hits everything that we try to do on a day-to-day basis, from making a difference in patient outcomes as well as educating the providers in the ED. And I think we all kind of at times consider ourselves simple people, and this was a very simple intervention that's easy to follow and easy to use.
Rob, how about you?
Yeah, I completely agree. This is no cost, just straightforward, thinking about what you need to do. And most importantly, I used to kind of worry that we were stressing all these points and kind of losing the forest for the trees. And I wondered if our interventions in the first hour, 2 hours of mechanical ventilation truly made a difference. And this study just really slams that point home, that it really does make a difference. These points that we're making are really important, and we should continue to pay attention to our ventilator settings.
Well, all right, we've reached our final article here for our top articles of 2017. And let's kind of stick on the mechanical ventilation theme. Specifically, John, over the past few years, actually, we have certainly promoted an analgo-sedation type of practice for intubated patients, starting off with analgesics and then providing a sedative. But also, we've emphasized the importance of titrating to lower levels of sedation. Anything from 2017 that tells us how we're doing with respect to levels of sedation?
Well, in fact, there was, Michael. And this study was by Stevens and a few others, and it was published in Chest, which we actually did a deeper dive on this, but it'll be nice to go through and hit the high notes of this study, which was titled Analgo Sedation Practices and the Impact of Sedation Depth on Clinical Outcomes Amongst Patients Requiring Mechanical Ventilation in the ED. A cohort study. So the objectives of this study were simply to characterize modern ED analgo sedation practices, and then after that, assess the relationship between sedation depth and how our patients did. So this was actually a secondary analysis of a prospective observational cohort study from a single tertiary academic medical center, and they included patients who were over the age of 18 and basically anyone who received mechanical ventilation through an endotracheal tube. They did exclude patients who died within 24 hours and were on ventilator chronically. They did also exclude patients who were transferred. Obviously, that would complicate the ability to analyze the depth of sedation early on, as well as patients with neurologic injury and sudden cardiac arrest as a result of their mechanical ventilation. And so what they did was they measured the depth of sedation using a standardized score. So the RASS score is the one that they used, and they defined deep sedation as a RASS of -3 to -5. So basically on the absolute left side of that sedation scale. And in patients where no RASS was documented, they used the first ICU RASS as a surrogate if it was measured within the first 3 hours of ICU admission. And as mentioned before, the primary outcome was mortality, but the secondary outcomes were ventilator days, hospital days, and ICU-free days. They analyzed about 400 patients, and 317 of those were intubated in the emergency department. And a majority underwent RSI with succinylcholine or rocuronium with a sedative of etomidate or ketamine. Now, here were the sedation practices. So, interestingly enough, we do a pretty good job at providing the analgo part of the analgo sedation. So 85% of patients receive fentanyl post-intubation, and about 60% of those, interestingly enough, did receive some form of midazolam. And it's unclear whether or not that was an infusion or a single dose after paralytic. In terms of other sedatives, propofol was used fairly commonly at about 47%, and then 16% received ketamine. Now, 59 of those patients, interestingly enough, received no analgesia whatsoever, and 63 of them received no sedation while in the emergency department. So this was about 1 out of every 5 patients didn't receive any analgesia as well as or sedation while in the emergency department. 1 out of 5, so that's pretty high. So in terms of outcomes, the median RASS score was -3. So In terms of looking at the current guidelines, in terms of recommendations from the PAD guidelines that were published about 3 years ago, in general, we try to go somewhere between -2 and 0. So this was a little bit south of that. And deep sedation was observed in about 64% of all patients who were included in this study. Now, the primary outcome occurred in 60 of the patients, so about 15% of receiving deep sedation. And RASS was deeper in patients who died, so -4, compared with those who survived, which was -3. So survivors had a less deep sedation scale early on in the ED. And when they did associations in terms of mortality, a deeper ED RASS was associated with a higher mortality. And certainly, it looks like there was no difference between whether or not these were trauma or medical patients. So at the end of the day, as we take this home, what were the limitations? Well, this was a single center study, so certainly this could reflect local practices, and it was a retrospective study as well. So certainly the data wasn't as clean as if it were done in a prospective fashion. Sedation depth was inconsistently recorded in the ED, and this partly could be due because it's not something that we're commonly doing, or maybe something new in terms of our ED nurses recording RASS scores. This certainly requires some education on our part to make sure that it's done early and effectively. And I think the overall take-home point is simply this, that deep sedation is common in mechanically ventilated ED patients, and it is associated with worse outcomes. I think my takeaway home point from this as well, a secondary one, is every patient's different, and certainly early on, if the patient is really sick, you're trying to accomplish a lot of things, you're going to probably sedate them a little bit more than you would otherwise. But I think at the end of the day, it's important that we lighten up that sedation quickly because it is associated, it does appear to impact our patient's outcome. So how about you guys? What do you think?
Peter, I'll turn to you.
Well, we literally just discussed this past Friday at our critical care meeting because I was a big proponent of making sure we were addressing pain first for our patients. But then the big pushback was, look, everybody wants us to move away from narcotics. And so the give and take was, initially, we can go ahead and use fentanyl and then wean that relatively quickly, because you could imagine being on a fentanyl drip for 20 days and then you got separate problems in the ICU. But the other issue, the overarching issue from the ICU folks, was exactly what we're presenting in this paper, which is, number one, we're over sedating people routinely. I mean, way too deep. Way too deep. And so I think that this is not just an educational piece for our physicians in the ED or our physicians in the ICU, but the nursing level has got to be touched by this. The people who are with the patients 24/7, 365 need to be able to change their practice and really reflect and see how deep they're placing the patients. Because as you mentioned, John, the deeper you are, the greater your risk is.
Yeah, really well said, Peter. I don't have much to add other than to continue to emphasize that we need to pay attention to the level of sedation that we're taking patients to in the ED. Much like ED mechanical ventilatory settings matter, yes, depth of sedation appears to matter as well. Well, gentlemen, this has been super helpful. Lots of pearls from these five articles here in part two. In terms of sepsis, antibiotic timing does make a difference. Protocolized therapy, not good across the board for all comers, and certainly in resource-limited settings, it was associated with an increase in mortality compared with usual care. Don't forget about that second dose of antimicrobials, especially in your boarding ED patients. Set the ventilator right. A no-cost intervention is simply to have that tape measure. Get the right predicted body weight, set the tidal volume, bring the head of the bed up to 30 degrees, set the PEEP appropriately, lower your FiO2 as soon as possible, and follow your plateau pressures, and then be careful and continue to monitor the depth of sedation in your ED mechanically vented patients. We have a deeper dive on each of these articles, both in part one and part two, in our handout that's posted on the website. If you have any questions or comments or feedback, please let us know. Shoot us an email. We'll be happy to either put those on a subsequent podcast or send you an email reply. But my thanks to John, Peter, and Rob for an outstanding part two discussion and a really great January in terms of starting us off in 2018. More to come with respect to website redesign and those new features. You should be seeing that right around the time that we post this part two. For now, we're going to sign off, and we will look forward to talking to you on our next podcast.